At the U.S. Open Tennis Championship in New York, Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal are still alive. They could meet up in the finals. The top-seeded American, Andy Roddick, has been knocked out. One of the great American players of the past who dropped by the tournament is a former U.S. Open champ, Andre Agassi, who was once the top tennis player in the world. He retired in 2006. He returned to the Open this year to sign copies of his autobiography, Open, which is now out in paperback. That meant he was at the Open as a spectator.
You know, it's a flood of emotions for me when I come back to New York any time during the year, but especially this time. It's memories that take me so far back to a wild teenager being called a punk from somebody in the stands, to some of my greatest victories, to obviously the last memory I have here on the court, which was me saying goodbye to a sport I've played my whole life. So just a flood of emotions. I'm never quite sure how to place it, but it always feels great.
I read somewhere that you showed up at the U.S. Open and signed some books, but did not want to be in the spotlight, didn't want to be part of the festivities, which you're Andre Agassi. You could easily have been. You didn't do interviews there. Was that a conscious choice on your part?
You know, I'm selective with how I engage with the game and where I engage with the game, you know, and my interest is contributing, you know. It's not about, you know, being out there celebrating anything for myself, you know. I mean, the book that I spent 3 years writing, I believe, is going to affect people generationally speaking. I think it's going to have a huge impact.
What do you mean by affect people generationally speaking?
Well, you know, I mean, my book, I don't know if you've read it or not, but it's, you know, I've poured thousands of hours into it, making sense of a life that people can relate to in a lot of different ways. You know, my life was about a lot of rebellion. My life was about identity issues and being labeled and being told who I was by older people. My life was about forgiveness of yourself, forgiveness of your parents. It's a book that's going to help teenagers find themselves.
Well, let's talk about that, because you're talking about trying to affect teenagers. When you were a teenager, you write, even though you were being pressed to play tennis and you were tremendously talented, you didn't like it.
Yeah, I had a real hate for the game early on, and the hatred came from what it felt like it was doing to my life. You know, I was a child of four, and I was a baby of the family, and, you know, everybody had that plan in their future from my father to be a great tennis champion, the quickest road to the American dream, him being an Armenian living in Iran, immigrant.
So your father wanted you to be a great tennis champion.
He wanted me to be a great tennis. So the life was chosen certainly for me at that stage, and then got sent away to a tennis academy and Bradenton, Florida at 13, where I started sort of that rebellion. So tennis always represented kind of a lot of drama in my life early on.
What has your family said about the book since it's been published?
My mom had a hard time reading the early years to hear. You know, I write the book in present tense, so it's pretty powerful to read what a 7-year-old is feeling and thinking and how it relates to your environment at home. When she got past those first few chapters, then she settled into it and was really proud of me for it. My father hasn't read it, told me he wouldn't, says he'd do the same thing over again, except it wouldn't be tennis, it'd be baseball or golf. Because he felt like I could play it longer and make more money. So it's nice to know some things don't change in life.
Why did your father refuse? Did he know what was coming? He had an even when he wasn't sure what you were writing, he said, "I'm not going to read this."
Yeah, he just said, you know, he's embarrassed about the fact that he doesn't read very well. You know, he speaks 5 languages, none of them very well at all. You know, turning his lens on himself hasn't been a luxury he's had in his life. He came here not speaking a word of English and held 2 jobs and raised 4 kids. So I think he just wanted me to go through my my experience with it and call it as I saw it.
It's commonly said that there hasn't been a truly great American tennis player on the stage since you retired. Andy Roddick, of course, is very, very good, but as if to underline the story, he's been upset at the U.S. Open this week.
Well, you know, I got to believe that if Federer and Nadal were around when me and Pete were playing,
Sampras.
Yeah, you might be asking somebody else, you know, why Pete and Andre aren't great, because, you know, you got guys out there right now that are doing things that are pretty remarkable, and Andy certainly has been in a tough time as it relates to coming into a dynasty of a couple champions there that are taking all the prizes. But he's one hell of a competitor, I tell you, and certainly brings a lot of a lot to the table. And you know, he's getting older now, and priorities sometimes shift. There's a lot of different decisions that need to get made, and if he makes them right, he still has a window of time to do some great things.
So you're not saying Americans have gotten worse. You're saying that Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, who are not Americans, are just that good that they obliterate anybody else.
Well, that's certainly how it's been. It's not brain surgery to realize how much they've dominated, but what I'm sort of suggesting across the board, I think, is that globally speaking, tennis has gotten much more competitive. I think with the technology that's happened in the strings, it's changed the kind of athlete we're seeing now. We're seeing guys who rely a lot on their legs, play a long way behind the baseline, 6'4", taller, and still move well. And they swing for the fences and get rewarded for those swings. And you got courts like Wimbledon grass that's playing more like a hard court, and the indoor courts, the balls are heavier and the courts are slower. So the child that's growing up in America playing on the fast hard courts is challenged in a different way than we used to be throughout the year. Usually that was the best way to learn tennis, and then you go, you adapt to the clay. But now with where everything's falling, it's better to be growing up on the slow surfaces, learning how to adapt your game to a few occasions where you have to play quicker courts.
Mm. Now that you don't have to play tennis, do you ever play?
I do every now and then. You know, I do some charity stuff for my foundation. I tie that into some exhibitions across the globe here and there. I take my wife out every now and then when she wants some exercise. She talks me into hitting the ball and running her around, which I appreciate because she hits the ball back to me, and I still like.
You have Steffi Graf for a sparring partner.
Yeah, I still like the feeling of the ball off my strings. I just don't like the feeling of my body on the pavement.
A little hard on the knees and the ankles.
Yes, everything. Just the ground is getting further away from me every day.
Andre Agassi's book, Open, an autobiography, is now out in paperback. Thanks very much.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for your time.
Morning Edition from NPR News is produced by Barry Gordimer and Kara Tallow. Our senior producers include Tom Bullock, Cindy Carpian, Jim Wildman, Tracy Wall, and J.J. Sutherland. Our executive producer is Madalika Sika. The executive director of news programming is Alan McDonald. Morning Edition's theme music was written by B.J. Lederman and arranged by Jim Pugh. Renee Montaigne is on assignment, traveling toward Afghanistan on this holiday weekend. I'm Steve Inskeep. Now, after the BP oil spill, federal, state, and BP-hired scientists are monitoring the Gulf of Mexico for signs of oil contamination, all of which is not good enough for some communities that want independent verification of what the spill has left behind. Here's NPR's Debbie Elliott.
In Orange Beach, Alabama, it's Ted Skerritt's business to know the condition of the beach.
Today's a good day.
Waves are lapping the shore, and Skerritt's workers have set out rows of wooden lounge chairs with royal blue cushions and umbrellas. Skerritt owns Perdido Beach Services, a company that rents beach equipment. He's thrilled that the wind is blowing out of the north on this Labor Day weekend, when local businesses are hoping to get an end-of-summer boost after a miserable season. Skerritt noticed recently that when the wind was coming in strong from the south, over a foamy, churned-up gulf, something new was going on.
Whatever's in that foam, in that breaking surf area, is carried onto the beach area by that wind.
Just like you might get a film of sea spray on your sunglasses, the beach workers, like Matt Cole, felt a greasier material.
You could actually feel it in your hair and stuff. And then we came back and we noticed when we were pulling some of the umbrellas, they were really slippery. And this is the first time something like this happened. And you could rub your finger along the shaft of the aluminum pole on the umbrella, and it was kind of like a oily brown substance.
Skerritt doesn't believe what BP and federal officials say about most of the oil being gone. He wants better information to protect his workers.
I have a lot of questions, but I don't know how to even ask them.
And he's not the only one. Orange Beach City Hall has been inundated with calls from residents with complaints. Foam that they think is dispersant, a gray metallic slick in back bays, or seaweed that looks oiled. There's a heightened sense of environmental awareness, and local officials are looking for a way to determine what's really going on. Mayor Tony Cannon says that's why the town hired independent scientists to test the air, water, and soil.
Very few folks trust the government, and very few folks trust BP. We want to be able to say we have a clean bill of health. And when we say that, we have our own independent data, our own objective information to back up what we're selling.
Jody Blunt steers a boat into Weeks Bay. He and geologist Mark White are out to collect soil and water samples at one of the 15 sites they're monitoring.
Anywhere on that point, if I'm with you, you want to try to find...
No, I think anywhere in this area is, I mean, you know, we selected that site from the map, so...
Right.
They stop at a stand of needle rush grass, and Blunt wades into the shallow water with a sample jar. These samples contained no oil, but the team has found isolated cases of hydrocarbon levels that exceed safe exposure limits, both in the Gulf and in Back Bay waters. Geologist Mark White has also confirmed that oil was apparently airborne, coating the sea oats that line the sand dunes. He runs a white napkin along the stem of the plant, and it comes back with a greasy brown tinge.
See, you can kind of see the oily appearance of it, but no odor. Problematic for sure.
White says no trends have surfaced in their 2 months of testing, and with changing currents, tides, and winds, he says, only long-term monitoring will give residents the answers they're looking for.
We are trying to figure it out, but we're living in it while we're trying to figure it out. And it's not, there's no silver bullet that says this is unsafe.
Orange Beach is using grant money from BP for the testing and putting the data on the town's website. Mayor Kennan says negative results could affect tourism in the short term, but he says finding the truth is more important. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Good morning. I'm Steve Inskeep. This was supposed to be the recovery summer. The economy was supposed to heat up thanks to a wave of public works projects funded by the government's stimulus program. But summer is ending and the recovery has not taken root. Today, the Labor Department released August unemployment numbers, which remain high, climbing a bit, in fact, to 9.6%. Before long, stimulus dollars will be fading like autumn leaves. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on a season of discontent.
On the Friday before the summer solstice, President Obama joined a crowd in hard hats in Columbus, Ohio, to announce a $15 million effort to widen the roadway, add bike lanes, and press the accelerator on the nation's economic turnaround.
Today, I return to Columbus to mark a milestone on the road to recovery, the 10,000th project launch under the Recovery Act. That's worth a big round of applause.
It was the beginning of what the White House called Recovery Summer. And part of what needed recovery was the reputation of the government's $787 billion stimulus program. While many economists believe that program has worked to boost employment, the public is not impressed. Outgoing White House advisor Christina Romer acknowledged this week the president's team underestimated the depths of the recession, and in front-loading the stimulus with tax cuts and aid to states, they opted for speed over visibility.
As happened with many decisions, pragmatism won out. We agreed that many of the things that would improve the economy fastest were unglamorous measures, many of which don't come with Recovery Act signs or easily identifiable links to the Act. It's been hard for people to see what the Act has done.
Recovery Summer was supposed to change that as more federal dollars were poured into easily recognizable public works, including 15,000 road projects, enough to crisscross the country 10 times.
There are so many going on, you almost can't take a drive this summer without seeing orange cones.
John Horsley, who heads an association of state transportation officials, says all those federally funded road projects have kept some 74,000 construction workers busy this summer, but that's not enough to patch the country's giant economic pothole. With housing in a deep slump, unemployment in construction still tops 17%. President Obama joked back in June that the hungry road crews in Columbus would keep area restaurants busy. But it didn't work out that way for John Plank, who owns a nearby pizzeria.
We're third generation, started in 1939. My brother and I run it, and our sister helps us a little.
Plank says business has been slow this summer, in part because the road construction makes it hard for customers to reach his restaurant. He hoped to at least capitalize on the day of the president's visit, but the expected crowds didn't materialize.
I hate to say it, but, you know, it's our worst Friday we've had in 10 years just because nobody could get to us. You know, I thought there were going to be all kinds of people down there, but I guess there was only 30 to 40 people, and they were all from Washington.
Plank does think pizza sales will pick up this fall, especially if the Ohio State Buckeyes have a good season. But not everyone is so patient. Private sector hiring dropped off sharply in this country after the Greek debt crisis, and by mid-August, the president's Gallup approval rating had fallen to a record low of 41%. It's bounced back a bit since then, but congressional Democrats still face the prospect of big losses in November. White House political advisor David Axelrod says the recovery is taking longer than anyone would like.
There are still 15 million people looking for jobs. There's still a great deal of uncertainty. You know, we have challenges that we have to continue to fight through, and it is not going to be a straight line. It is not going to be easy.
On Monday of this week, President Obama huddled with his economic advisors, looking for new ways the government could promote hiring.
How are we doing on sound, guys?
But as the president spoke to reporters in the Rose Garden afterwards, even a balky White House audio system seemed to be working against him.
Can you guys still hear us? Okay. Let me try this one more time.
The president might not get many more tries at recovery. This is one summer Mr. Obama is probably happy to put behind him. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Now let's talk about one of your entertainment options as we head into this holiday weekend. George Clooney is an actor who seems equally at home in big summer blockbusters and serious smaller films, and his latest is an attempt to combine the two. Kenneth Turan has our review.
The American is a bleak, distant thriller that's easier to appreciate than to love. If an austere European minimalist had directed a James Bond film, it might have turned out like this. George Clooney plays Jack, a top-of-the-line American assassin facing a crisis. People are shooting at him for no apparent reason, so Jack retreats to Italy and confers with his contact in a deserted cafe.
Take a right outside the bar, then second left. You'll find a dark blue Fiat Tempra with Pescara plates. I've marked a small town on the map, Castelvecchio. Stay there, lay low, till you get my call.
Soon enough, Jack gets an assignment to construct a high-quality weapon for another assassin, a mysterious woman. Jack also has time for a steamy liaison with the gorgeous Clara.
I'm here.
What are you doing tonight?
I work tonight.
Don't. If I ask you to come away with me, would you?
She's the latest in the long line of stunningly beautiful movieland women who just happen to be working as prostitutes in out-of-the-way bordellos. Who knew? Jack is a very different, more removed character than Clooney usually plays, a man all but unreachable behind his dark glasses. It completely avoids the actor's usual high-wattage smile and suave good humor. Director Anton Corbijn is a former photographer, so every frame of The American is impeccably composed and beautifully shot. This high level of craft is satisfying, but it can involve us emotionally for only so long. Jack's girlfriend brings some life to his existence and the movie, but don't get your hopes up, for while many of its elements whet our appetite and make the film worth seeing, The American doesn't manage to deliver a fully satisfying meal.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and for the Los Angeles Times. You know, the new healthcare law is pretty complicated, and there are many real questions about how or whether it will work, which makes it all the more amazing that so much of the political debate has been completely fact-free. NPR's Julie Robner set out to see where some false claims about healthcare came from.
One of the most persistent rumors circulating on the internet is this one, voiced here by a participant at a town hall meeting last summer held by South Carolina Congressman Bob Inglis.
One of the things that's in there, and it's on page 1000 to 1007, I have it right here printed directly from the bill. They want to put a chip in every one of us. It talks about it right here.
It's not true, by the way. The health law is silent on the subject of microchips. But Timothy Jost, a law professor at Washington and Lee University, has spent much of the summer tracing the origin of some of these health care horror predictions. He says this one's based on a proposal to have the Food and Drug Administration keep track of implantable medical devices.
We're talking about things here like pacemakers, hip implants, things like that, that when they fail, we know what's going on and we know the incidence of it and we know how serious the failures are.
The implantable medical device registry was included in the health bill that passed the House last November. Also circulating on the internet were videos of the first microchip with medical information approved for implant in humans, which happened several years ago. What happened in effect, says Jost, is some people put two and two together and got something a lot more than four.
People combing the web found these microchips and saw this implantable medical device registry as an attempt to implant microchips in people. And then the rumor expanded to say that all people who signed up for the public plan that was in that bill would have to have a microchip implanted.
In the end, however, neither the public plan nor the device registry made it into the final version of the bill that became law. One thing that did make it into the final bill is a provision to create a uniformed ready reserve within the public health service. This has been widely misinterpreted as the creation of a private civilian army for President Obama. Here's how Fox News analyst Andrew Napolitano put it this spring.
It is very scary that the president would have this private army. Why does he need an army?
Judge, to help keep us healthy.
Well, first of all, says Jost, it's not a private army.
Now, the public health service is, and I think a lot of people don't realize it, is one of our uniform branches of service.
And this actually dates back to a proposal first made by the Bush administration. In the wake of 9/11, officials realized that many of those uniformed public health personnel were not ready to deploy in a health emergency.
So what this legislation does is to fund a ready reserve corps that can be called up in times of national emergency to assist the public health service for things like Hurricane Katrina or a nationwide epidemic.
And that's not the only part of the law people are dramatically misinterpreting. There's also been some hyperbole about how the requirement that nearly everyone have health insurance will be enforced by the Internal Revenue Service. This is Texas Republican Congressman Ron Paul on Fox Business News.
Just think about it. 16,500 armed bureaucrats coming to make this program work.
It's incredible.
It was a good program and everybody liked it. You wouldn't need 16,500
exactly.
thugs coming with their guns and putting you in jail if you didn't follow all the rules. Exactly.
Jost says this, too, is based on a kernel of truth. An estimate last year that the IRS could need an additional $5 to $10 billion over the next 10 years to enforce the law. But jackbooted IRS agents coming to your door with guns?
None of that is true. I mean, the penalty is there. It will require some IRS resources to remind people that they owe it. There are no criminal penalties. They can't levy against your property. They can't impose liens. The money is mainly there to help people get tax credits to help them with their health insurance costs.
While some of the wild stories are certainly just misinterpretations, Drew Waltman of the Kaiser Family Foundation says there's also something else going on, particularly by Republicans.
They're using health reform to try and whip up voters about Washington and big government. And so health reform becomes a device in a bigger game.
That bigger game, in other words, the next election. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
This Labor Day weekend will mean camping trips for many people, and if you're among them and you're trying out a new tent or fishing rod, you're not alone. While people have cut back on their spending, in many areas the sales of outdoor gear are going strong. Saves on the hotel bill. Colorado Public Radio's Megan Verlee has the story.
Mike Fatica is in the market for a new sleeping bag.
This is synthetic?
Oh, yeah. Now, all the orange tag ones are synthetic and the down is the
green. Oh, that helps.
All around are big displays of bright colored sleeping bags, climbing shoes, and backpacks. This is Wilderness Exchange Unlimited, an outdoor gear store in Denver.
Climbing is a very good metaphor for running a business. It's taking calculated risks.
That's Don Boucher. He's Wilderness Exchange's owner and an avid climber. Last year, he took a big risk by moving the store to a larger space.
On the outside, if you look at it, it's kind of insane. We decided to increase our expenses to almost twice what they were in our old space during the heart of the recession. We moved in, you know, middle of the end of 09. But it was the right decision at the right time. We're up in sales as a business.
And that is pretty much the story for outdoor gear in general. The industry says its sales dipped only 2% last year and are up more than 8% this year. That's a bigger increase than retail sales overall. People who bike, hike, and kayak are often from higher income brackets. But Frank Hugelmeyer says the recession also seems to have more people wanting to get away from it all. He's the president of the Outdoor Industry Association.
People go back to outdoor activities. They go to close-to-home recreation. They go to affordable family vacations. And that's our industry.
Hugelmeyer says changing attitudes are also helping sales. People look at outdoor recreation as more of a lifestyle these days. That means instead of just sticking to rock climbing or kayaking, people are trying a lot of different sports.
Once introduced to the active outdoor lifestyle, you will try anywhere from 4 to 6 activities as a participant, and you'll hone in on 3 to 4 and do those fairly regularly.
All those activities can add up to a garage full of gear. Finding the people buying this stuff is easy, at least here in Colorado. Just drop by any campground.
Have you had to buy any gear recently?
Not had to, but have. We've bought a lot of gear.
Ann Taylor and her friends are exploring the Mount Evans Wilderness outside of Denver. This is their 5th camping trip of the summer, and they've come well supplied. Tent, hiking boots, camp kitchen. Taylor says she shops sales and discount websites as much as possible to stock up for camping and backpacking. But she admits not all her purchases are purely practical.
Yeah, I mean, there's always like, ooh, that's so much lighter and smaller, and that just looks cool. So sometimes, I mean, we definitely have more than one tent. So, you know, sometimes if something cool comes up.
Even accounting for a few impulse buys, Taylor's friend Joe Kugenmeister says loading up on equipment pays off in the long term.
Once you get that down, it's not very expensive to come out here. Obviously, you just have a little food and, you know, a little gas to drive out. So it actually is a lot cheaper than if we would say, like, stay in the city and, like, go out to, like, dinner or to a bar or, like, anything. You guys want to, like, maybe take a little bit of a hike?
Yeah. Absolutely. Should we get water or are we not going to go that extreme?
No, I think
no.
We should.
Yeah, we'll get geared up.
Yeah, we'll get geared up.
These guys are far from alone in gearing up to hit the trails. I got to confess, if my interview's done, I got the pack on, the dog with me, and I'm going to hit the trails too. And yeah, it is a pretty new pack. For NPR News, I'm Megan Verlee in the Mount Evans Wilderness of Colorado.